of we're doing some very serious UFO investigation. We want to go deeper. We want to go beyond where you usually hear and see. And to do that, we're going to be talking today to Paola Harris, a very special UFO investigator. She's an Italian-American photojournalist. She's an investigative reporter. She specializes on extraterrestrial-related phenomena. She's widely published. She has got her finger on both the European and the American situations. She was J. Allen Hynek's assistant from 1980 to 1986. That's right. She assisted the great J. Allen Hynek in his UFO investigators. She has met with Colonel Philip Corso. Of course, she has met with yours truly. She was one of the first to come into contact with me after Communion was published with an open mind, very unusual at that time in the UFO community. So welcome, Paola Harris. She is also, I might add, the author of Connecting the Dots, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomenon, which she has been on our show to talk about before. An extraordinary researcher, Paola Harris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Whitley. This is fun. I'm glad to talk to you.
Well, Paola, I understand that you have just come back from Ireland, if I'm not correct, and we hear very little about UFO phenomena in Ireland.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing a lot of traveling this year, mainly because I have a new book called Exopolitics, How Do You Speak to a Ball of Light, which has a lot of the political political issues around the ufology. And so I was coming out of the X conference in Washington, D.C., and 2 days later I flew into Ireland, and synchronicity would have it that the Irish opened up their UFO files on the 20th of September, the day that I flew in. So I was on Good Morning Ireland, and I explained this whole entire phenomenon in a very logical and in a very precise way. And really, I heralded the journalist, Alison Healy, who through the Freedom of Information Act, she's an Irish journalist, was responsible for opening up the Irish files. So I'm really happy this is happening worldwide.
When I was in Ireland in, I believe, 1989, which is not quite a while ago, I was on a big Irish television show also, and I was very surprised to find after the show, one person after another would come up to me in the street and tell me about the most extraordinary UFO sightings, including seeing UFOs on the ground and so on and so forth in Ireland, things they didn't talk about publicly because the general atmosphere toward this was, at that time at least, very negative. People would have been quite embarrassed to be public about it. What is the situation now?
Well, right now, there, you know, I talked to the journalist, Alison Healy. I called her right away at the Irish Times, and I said, how come it's on the front page? And she said, well, you know, we have these weird stories on the front page. So, Paula, she says, this is really still in the area of weirdness. In other words, slowly but surely, it's becoming more more in the consciousness of the people. But it's still creeping in, Whitley. It still isn't right in there as something serious, and certainly something that could be a matter of national defense or a matter of looking at this as a political situation. So yeah, I mean, it's getting a little bit better. I mean, it's creeping in steps and bounds.
Well, so it is creeping in. What are some of the and we're going to be talking a little bit about the exopolitics situation and what it may mean for the future in just a few minutes. But tell us first, if you will, a little bit about those Irish UFO revelations when they opened their files.
Well, most of them are sightings. And the thing that's great, because they gave me the files, and then, you know, we had a meeting. You and I also met in Denver with Anne. I gave you the files, so they're fun to read because basically they're people sightings. So most of these people live in rural areas, and they don't know who to call, so they call the military, and they report these type of sightings where in certain counties they'll have a sighting, and it usually the one that they talked about on the front page was a 10-year-old boy who reported a UFO that made a buzzing sound like a chainsaw and bright lights, which dazzled him. And then it was in near Tipperary. So, I mean, the thing that's wonderful is slowly but surely what's happening is they've got these files, and now you and I have them, too, to look them over. And they're looking at real cases. They're taking people seriously, something they haven't been doing in a long time, because I think you and I are both interested in witness testimony. And these are witnesses. They're credible people. I don't think they're going to make something like this up.
Well, probably not. However, one of the things the files didn't contain was any indication of any military involvement in Ireland in this subject.
Yeah, but the files were still classified. They were on the. Why would they classify, you know, regular witnesses?
Right.
If they're classified, I mean, let's look at this logically. A 10-year-old boy makes a report and it becomes classified, and then if you looked at them, some of them are really blacked out. There's some blacked out pages there. Why would you do that if it's not something that's very important and it's something that's, in a way, you don't want to make public? I mean, it's only...
Well, exactly. There is a lot of blacked out material, and do you have any indication of what might be under those blacked out areas?
I think that's just the names of people. I think they don't want you going and snooping. I mean, if somebody wanted to really take this on, we could look at where these people are, we could look at their names, and we could go and question ourselves. I don't think they want us doing that. You know, it would mean that we would look into it deeper. And so,
yes.
You know, they don't want us snooping. But it's still a revelation. I mean, I'm still happy they still released these 30 files.
Yes. And it's 30 files over how many years?
Oh, I think it was from 1960 to 1984. The document's 1947 to 1984.
That's right, 1947 to 1984. So what we're looking at is 30 events over all of those years. And you have to wonder if there isn't a lot more in their files, just like there are in the British Ministry of Defense files, because Nick Pope told me that.
Yeah, there are. But you know what's so insignificant, Whitley, and this is why I love working in Europe, is that they use the word UFO. Here, if you use the word UFO, it means little green man. It means some kind of commercialization. Then everybody laughs, and they use the word green, the way they did in that silly Post article that they wrote about a very serious conference, the X conference, which had worldwide participation of researchers from all over the world coming together in Washington, D.C., and they use the word green men. They can't get off it. And so in Ireland, at least, which is a green country, they didn't use the word green men.
Well, you know, Paula, I think one of the reasons for the secrecy in the United States is, and the fact is that other countries have followed suit, is that whatever happened in the late 40s and early 50s was somehow a problem. Things were screwed up. And I believe that probably as a result of this, essentially the U.S. government failed in an attempt to make contact, probably, my guess is, because we shot first and asked questions later, and it put us into a category that was different from the category we as human beings might have wanted to be in. I learned from my own close encounter experiences that there aren't any second chances with the Greys. You do it right, or it's over, period, forever. There's no, they don't really operate on the system of, well, you'll try it this time, and then if you don't do it right, well, we'll try another time. They're very educational, don't get me wrong. I mean, they were very patient with me over years. But when it came time to do it, if I did not function in the way they expected and had taught me to, then there was never a second chance. And I think, basically, the United States government didn't get a second chance, and the result is the whole human species didn't get a second chance, and that's what they're hiding. It's just a theory.
Well, you know, I like your theory, and you have this incredible article, The Elephant Stampeding in the Living Room, that I've got on my website in three different languages, and we had this conversation that you also thought that the visitors were involved in the secrecy, which is a whole new kind of theory, and I think it's very interesting and very possible.
Well, I think it's probably true, and the reason is that if they are able, as they seem, then one thing is clear. They are certainly very secretive, because in all of these years of the close encounter and abduction phenomenon, there is nothing but a smattering of possible photographs. And I just say possible. There are implants, and there's a wealth of that material, which is being totally ignored by science, unfortunately. There's one in my own ear. But in terms of video evidence and photographic evidence and even witness evidence of abductions actually taking place, the number of really credible witness stories you can count on the fingers of one hand. I know a guy, for example, who probably saw my abduction, but he won't come out publicly. So, because he was a state patrolman, and he still is, and he doesn't want his job, his career to be ruined. So the result is, they could make this much more public, and they do not. The visitors do not, on the one hand. On the other hand, you talk about a theater in the sky, UFOs are everywhere. They make no secret of that, certainly.
No, that's true. And, you know, when I speak in the United States, and I've done a lot of speaking this year, I bring in the European videos and the European side, because people think that, you know, they look at it as a colonial kind of phenomenon. And the truth of the matter is that people are abducted in France, in Italy, in Switzerland, all over. And they're people that are simple people. They're not making this up. A lot of them are farmers. A lot of them happen to be outside at the wrong time. And, you know, I have these cases, these European cases, and I show them some incredible footage, I mean, daylight footage of UFOs, and this comes from Europe. So people are sitting there going, well, you know, I wish we could get this kind of news in America. Well, of course not. It's not on the media. You're not going to get anything but the Phoenix Lights, and even then they didn't do a good job of reporting it on the media.
Well, the media has made a 60-year-long commitment in the United States that this is all silly and it's funny. And if it turned out to be true, it would profoundly discredit the primary media sources in the United States, network television, the great newspapers such as the Washington Post, the New York Times. And believe me, they are not going to let that happen if they don't absolutely have to. It just won't. No matter, you could present, and we'll be talking about the X conference in just a moment, you can present anything you want to at this point, and if it's not a dead alien, they're going to laugh at you no matter what. We'll be right back. And don't miss, at the end of this program, Linda Moulton Howe's sobering interview with Gerald Celente, the editor of Trends Magazine. She's been interviewing him for 10 years straight, and he has never made predictions like you're going to hear today. Plus, there's useful information about how to take economic shelter if necessary. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Paola Harris, the author of a number of books. Exopolitics is her latest book, and it's available on Amazon.com. You can get it through our Amazon store, or you can get it through Amazon.com directly. Paola was for many years assisted J. Allen Hynek, and she has remained in the UFO field ever since. And Paola, we are going to talk about the X-Politics Convention. Why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about what this is?
Okay, all X-Politics is, it's like a graduation of ufology. It says the alien presence is on Earth. Now, what do we do about it? It deals with the political and the society, the social issues, the anthropological issues, all the psychological issues with the presence of aliens on Earth, because we look at it as a fact. It's way past the sightings. What it does is it gets together a number of people from all over the world who are looking at this on an academic and scholarly level. Usually the people have done extensive reading. They've got a background in ufology. But what it is activism. And that's why I like it, Whitley, because with exopolitics, what happens is that there's huge meetings worldwide, and on a citizen, a galactic citizen diplomacy level, in other words, we sit around and talk about what we can do about this, it becomes activism instead of just reporting sightings and reporting happenings, because we've been doing that. We have enough of that archived to prove that this phenomenon is real. We're now in 2007, and we have to ask what's happening and how do we deal with it. So the two people that wrote the first books on exopolitics are Alfred Weber in Canada and Dr. Michael Sala, who was a professor at American University. And Dr. Michael Sala has worked on citizen diplomacy in Kosovo. He's worked for the government. But because he spoke at the X conference a number of years ago, he lost his job at American University. So he instituted the Exopolitics Institute, which gives online classes in ufology. So it becomes something serious. It's not something where everybody gets together and parties and, you know, wears silly hats. And, you know, in a way, I love Roswell, but the Roswell Festival of 2007 was a party. And when we do things like that, what happens is we can celebrate, but there's nobody that takes it seriously. But when you have college professors, when you have people like Jaime Maussan and Antonio Huneas from Chile and Gilles Daburde from France and Nick Pope from England and all these people meeting in Washington, D.C. and speaking at the Washington Press Club, it isn't a UFO party anymore. It becomes something serious where we all from all over the world get together and say, okay, now it's time to come clean. Let's look at what we have to deal with here, because it deals with serious decisions of the future.
Well, certainly the Washington Post didn't take it too seriously.
Well, they couldn't, but they did write an article. I mean, that's, you know, I've got to say, they did write an article, and they did say that this group of people was going after the candidate. This group of people meaning the exopolitics group of people, are trying to bring this into the election. I mean, Stephen Bassett has a question on YouTube for the candidates, whether they're willing to look into it, to have the courage to look into it. And Willie, I gotta tell you something else here. There is a researcher that is going to, in the future, you know, lambast the meeting in Washington. You know, the infighting among the UFO crowd is something that really turns me off as a professional journalist.
Oh, me too. I have, been a victim of that.
Well, you shouldn't be a victim of that. You're one of the most courageous people ever. You're known worldwide for having come out.
Well, you try to get me invited to a MUFON convention. I don't think so. I have been harmed by that community. And I really must say that there's no love lost between Whitley Strieber and MUFON and the UFO community just in general. I've really had enough of that in detail. But let's go ahead.
They haven't gone to contact yet in those agencies, because mostly they're still at the sighting stage. Because the sighting stage is something that is not dangerous. You don't take a risk with sightings, because sightings are real and you just look at the time and so forth.
But of course, Paola, if we went to another planet and found an intelligent species there, we certainly wouldn't still be just flying around after 60 years.
But people that are intelligent, Whitley, know this. There are so many scientists. When I was in Ireland, I met a scientist who was a physicist and an astronomer, both. And he told me that European scientists on the sly are looking at the UFO phenomenon. They know where the UFOs are. They know that they can come in and out of dimensional gates. He says they're united in looking at this. And he told me he would give me some information. These are scientists.
Now, you're telling me about gates, dimensional gates, and that's very interesting to me, because my thought is now that we probably aren't dealing, if at all, certainly not only, with people from another planet, but that they have some other way of addressing reality, and now that some a mathematician at Oxford is insisting that his calculations show that parallel universes must be real. Well, you know, one thinks that maybe we're dealing with something very much stranger than we had first thought.
Well, that's what your new book is about.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, I was listening to you talk about this. But it's about time that we talk about this. And I thank you so much for bringing this forward, because with the new quantum physics and theoretical physics, they're proving this to be true. The whole non-locality situation, the fact that things can materialize and dematerialize. I mean, we don't need a Uri Geller to do that. We know that that is a law of nature. The problem is you can't repeat that in the laboratory. And that problem is we don't have physics to explain real events. Real events are that you don't have to wait for the alien to come thousands of light years. He can appear right in your living room. Now, you can't explain that with modern-day physics, but it happens. And it doesn't only happen in America. It happens in Europe. It happens everywhere. People are not making up these stories, Whitley.
Well, of course not. And we had Anne read over 500,000 stories over the years where we were getting, before email, when we were still getting letter mail about these things from people who had read Communion. And obviously they weren't making them up, because most of these stories were far beyond what the imagination of the ordinary person could achieve, let alone even somebody with an extraordinary imagination. It was by no means what it has been made to appear among UFO investigators, which is that the same sort of beings appear again and again, and they are doing the same sort of things to people. And it's all like, it makes it look like a group of scientists from another world who are testing us and taking samples and experimenting. Maybe that's part of it, but it's far wilder than that. And for example, Paola, what do you make of this? In a lot of cases, when people have close encounter experiences, they also see their own dead friends, their dead relatives. I did. What does that mean?
Well, that means that you had a gateway into other dimensions. We stay in a very, very solid, you know, fourth dimensional reality. Probably we'd go crazy if we weren't in it. You know, it just settles us down. And we have watches on our wrists, and we measure time, which is totally ridiculous because time does not exist, and we have to give meaning to life. Now, one of the problems is that when you go to take all that away from your, you know, normal everyday human being, it causes a problem in his or her reality. But you can't ignore that the other realities exist, including there is no death. There are many realities. There's what's called a paranormal, and you know, Alan Hynek told me this, Whitley, so it's not something just that I've, you know, been thinking about. Alan Hynek told me that the paranormal factor in the UFO phenomenon was perhaps one of the most important factors. He said it's not cut and dry. He said there is multi-level dimensional reality, that that strange things are part of it, and that the idea that you can see it all, as you just mentioned, is part of the phenomenon. But you know something, Willie, if this would be studied in universities, if this would be studied in classes, if people could have intelligent dialogue about this, then people wouldn't feel so bad, and we'd get somewhere. And this is what exopolitics is about, where you sit down with an academic group of people and you discuss this on an intelligent level. And in Europe, when we have conferences, we have scientists, astronomers there, we have people that are in the professional field. We don't have, you know, people running around with little antenna on their head or T-shirts on. You know, we don't do it that way, and that's the only difference between Europe and America as far as I see for the UFO conferences.
We'll be back with Paola Harris in just a moment, and listen up, because we're going to be talking about some very, very unusual stuff in just a moment. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Paola Harris, one of the world's leading UFO investigators, an international investigator. Her scope includes both Europe and the United States and elsewhere in the world as well. She has investigated UFOs literally all over the world. She's been actively doing this since she worked with J. Allen Hynek. And Paola, in your book, Exopolitics, you refer to a number of things that are pretty remarkably outside of the envelope, as it were, like the Philadelphia experiment and J-Rod. Could you tell us a little bit about what J-Rod is and how you deal with that?
Yeah, that's under my chapter on time travel because, you know, as I said before, time travel or time, the mystery of time, is part of the UFO phenomenon. And I remember Colonel Corso, and I was very close to Colonel Corso. I had his book translated into Italian. He told me that he believed that the beings at Roswell were time travelers.
He told me that too.
Yeah, well, he did. He thought they were us from the future coming back because of the timing of the visitations, which was right around the discovery of the atom bomb and
yes,
the atom bomb testing. I mean, if people look at when these sightings are and where they are, there's a problem with nuclear on the planet. So this is, he told me that he thought they were time travelers, so I just listened. But then when the story of Dan Burrish came up, and Bill Hamilton, who's an excellent researcher, and then Linda Moulton Howe with her research, and she did excellent research with the Dan Burrish case, came up, and it had to do with a J-Rod being that actually lent himself to being tested at the S4 Area 51 base, that this microbiologist, and I had done another story with someone that like that, Dr. Michael Wolf. So when I heard that this microbiologist was working with a being that said he was us from the future, a mutation of a nuclear disaster, in other words, that we had had this nuclear disaster, that this being was he was one of the survivors of the Kingston, Arizona crash. And if you look at Ryan Wood's book, there is a being missing from that crash. Ryan Wood has a book on all the UFO crashes, and the Kingston, Arizona crash is in there. And
right.
And this being says that he will stay here so that they can see what they could develop for some kind of anecdote for what happened to him. And the fact that this being talked about dimensional portals and dimensional gates made me go and visit Dan Burrish 3 times. I don't do any of my research unless I see the people face to face. I can't do it from a book. So I flew to Las Vegas. I saw him 3 times. When he was speaking, he was extremely emotional. He was not making anything up. What he was doing was remembering. He was remembering. He had details. He knew what he was talking about. And so I am convinced that that story is very true. And it presents us with a lot of things we have to think about. Yeah,
tell us a little bit about Dan's story, because Dan's not here to tell us, and some of us may not have heard it.
Well, the Dan Burrish story has to do with the fact that Dan, like many people, was recruited to work on top secret black ops projects at Area 51. He was a microbiologist, but he was also a contactee, because he talks about the contact when he was very young. And so he told me that he was one of the many scientists that were in S4, and that he was asked as a microbiologist to go in and with a syringe extract tissue from the J-Rod being. He was also told not to communicate or touch the being, because in touching the being he would flash images or communicate with him. So he said he wore a white, sterile suit, much like, astronauts or whatever. He walked into the chambers where the J-Rod was sitting in the corner. There is an actual drawing that Burrish did. It's on my website. It's in my new book of the J-Rod being. He was very human-like. And when Burrish walked into the clean chamber, he said that the J-Rod being flashed right away in his mind the fact that he had a family and a son and what planet he came from. And he said when he took the syringe and put it in the arm of this being, that he felt the same pain the being felt with the extraction of this tissue. And he talked about this being. He said, I didn't want to get attached to him, he said, but he transmitted to me several emotions and several things about his life. And so I asked him, of course, in my interview, well, did you tell the government what he told him? He said, no, I told him he didn't say anything. He didn't. He said, I kept it secret, but he said I had a tremendous amount of compassion for this being who said that we needed to watch the future because we were up for another, if some kind of pattern in the timeline where we could have serious problems. I mean, serious problems on the nuclear side. You know, we have choices. We live on various timelines. If we follow one, we go into nuclear destruction. If we can change that timeline and maybe jump to another one, we avoid it.
Did he say anything about how to change timelines?
I think that all the people I've ever spoke to about timelines, and this includes Uri Geller, who's a very good friend of mine. By the way, thank God, Uri Geller came to America. He's in America, and he's got his show tonight, his first show. Uri, to me, is one of the most incredible representatives of the UFO phenomenon. It's a shame he doesn't talk more. But changing timelines is based on thought, positive energy, meditation, and much like what happened with Jose Aguilis in the 1986 with the harmonic convergence. You can change events by picturing the positive in numbers. You can change situations by prayer, meditation, and a spirituality, something that they're trying to keep us away from. If enough people did this, if enough people, like Edgar Mitchell told me that he could actually project thoughts from the moon, that they were testing him, his group of people, ESP, from the moon. Now, if Edgar
Edgar to say that in public. He told me the same thing. He's not. Yeah. He doesn't talk about it much, though.
Yeah, but he believes in positive thinking and positive in changing the reality. The change in the reality has to be in the minds of the people first. I mean, when he told me this about the experiments he did from the moon and how, well, NASA wasn't too happy about it. If you can transmit thought from the moon, do you have any idea what the implications for that would be? Like, it's incredible if enough people did it. I mean, when Jose Argyles did the harmonic conversion, they actually measured the Earth and the vibration of the Earth and the rotation, everything, and it affected the Earth. So he had 30,000 people doing it, though, at the same time. So,
well, I remember it very well.
Yeah, well, if 30,000 people can change your reality, and we can tell people that 30,000 people can change your reality, then maybe we won't have happening what might happen that the J-Rod was involved in.
Right. Now, what do you think we've mentioned dimensional gateways and so forth lately, and there is a profound connection between belief and reality, which is exemplified by the whole quantum perception problem, which has been known to be true for a long time, that perception is what fixes reality. Without perception, everything is in superposition. It's, if you can imagine, it's sort of out of focus. It has no definite reality. It seems to me that we're coming toward a really bad period, that J-Rod is right. There's too much going on here. You look at the environment, you look at the proliferation of nuclear weapons around the world, you look at these horrible countries, some of the worst countries in the world and the worst leaderships on the planet either have or are trying hard to acquire nuclear weapons. And I'll say this, two things seem to me on this timeline to be inevitable. One is, there will be nuclear weapons detonated over human beings on this timeline. And two is, the environment that we live in now is going to fundamentally change in ways that is going to make it really hard for the planet to continue to sustain large numbers of human beings. And we have this strange phenomenon the governments are so secretive about, and the people don't understand. They're sort of laughing about. It seems to involve the dead at times. It's so weird. And Paola, does it have any relevance? Does it matter, any of this stuff? Do UFOs and close encounters matter?
Well, it's all part of it. It's all part of it. I'm so glad you brought up what you brought up, because the truth of the matter is, yeah, the world is in a very precarious state right now. But let me tell you, you talked about perception being truth. If you live in Europe, their perception is that the American people are doing nothing to stop this war, that they're part of Bush. And I have to explain to everybody, no, mom, pa, and child, American person, is not agreeing with what's happening. And they're asking me, well, why don't they do something about it? Why don't the citizens do something about it? Because the perception in Europe is that we're approving this insanity. So the thing is that the perception is truth for those people. So maybe it's not the countries, it's the politicians that are dealing with the nuclear problem. Because I'm sure mom and pa want their kids to live, and they want to live an everyday life, and they want to be comfortable. And that goes for Iran, Iraq, all over the world. It's not just, I don't think we can lump people together. It is a very precarious time, Whitley, because there's games being played, and we don't know what the game is. We don't know what the game they're playing it is. However, I'm positively sure that with the raising of the vibration and the raising of our consciousness and the raising of awareness and the intelligent discussion of exopolitics, of the fact that we can have a UFO over O'Hare Airport in front of everybody. I don't think that UFO was on vacation. I think that was a sign. I think that some of the crop circles
I think they're showing themselves. precisely so that they enter our perception and we begin to realize that they're real. And the more we realize this, the more real they will become in this universe.
They're real, and they're also like Esin Sekerara from Turkey. She talked to me about this. She's a wonderful investigator. She said, you know, Paula, they're real, and they come just about a week before we have an earthquake. And people are looking up at the sky in Turkey, and they're going, oh, my God, there they are. And pretty soon the people were blaming the UFOs for the earthquakes because just before they had an earthquake, the UFOs were there. Well, you know, that happened in Stratford-on-the-Avon. There was more rain in England than there ever was. People were in boats, and they had these massive sightings at Stratford. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that there are a group, and it doesn't need to be the Greys or whatever, because there was a federation, I think. Colonel Corso told me there were 50 different races categorized in the Pentagon. So some federation or some group happens to appear before certain events. And I think they, you know, they probably have a directive where they can't get directly involved, but anybody who's awake and aware can understand that we're being told to clean up our act or else. You know, I mean, we're probably being told that that what we see is not the reality of what's out there, that we probably have another reality that we have to look at. Now, Whitley,
Paula, we have to take a little break right now. And Paula brought up an incredibly provocative statement, another reality that we have to take a look at. We're going to be taking a look at that very reality in just a minute. Stay tuned. We're talking to Paula Harris, UFO investigator, international UFO investigator Paula Harris. Her website is paulaharris.com. That's paulaharris.com. She is a European and American UFO investigator. She started out with J. Allen Hynek, so she's been at this for a good long while, and she is a real expert. Paula, when we talk about having to face different realities, different realities in regard to this phenomenon, what exactly are we talking about here?
We're talking about something so strange that most people want to just go back, turn on the television, and watch a game. Okay?
Fair enough.
I made a comedy out of it, but the truth of the matter is that, Willie, you're very courageous, and you and Ann are looking at this and are addressing this. Okay? But the average person is so comfortable that why would they do anything like this? I had a girlfriend once who told me, Paula, I don't want to hear about UFOs. I know they're real, but I don't want to worry about anything else. I got enough to worry about. So we live in a world where the people are to blame also the secrecy, because they don't want to face it. I mean, why would you want to face it when you got a comfortable life? Everything is less complicated, and you can just come home, have a couple of beers, and watch a game. I mean, you have to be someone who really has to be on a certain level to really look at this other reality. I don't know if you agree.
Well, yeah, I absolutely do agree. And I think that also that scientists might be more willing to look at it in terms of parallel universes because, in fact, if there was a living conscious presence in a parallel universe that was pressing to make itself real in our universe, Dr. John von Neumann wrote a paper about this back in the 50s, it would be almost inevitable that they would need us to perceive them as real in order to function freely in our universe. And that could be what they're trying to do. In other words, the abductions and so forth are the most they can manage in our universe now. But the more distant apparitions like UFOs and so forth it take less energy for them because of the fact that less of our perception has to be challenged. And so they do more of that and less of the abduction, but they're hoping to eventually get to a point where we realize that they're real. And, of course, if the government knows it already, then it would also know that their admission, governmental admission, and this was in the elephant in the living room, would be probably a tripwire. And therefore, they won't admit it. And the reason is simple. If they admit it, they open a door to this other universe, and they come pouring through, the visitors, whoever it is. But the problem is, if we don't like it, we can never close the door. So, even if it looks like it might be good, no president would ever decide to make this admission and open this door. How do you react to that?
Well, that's excellent, excellently put. You express that in a beautiful way, and you talk about it in your book too. But the door is already open. I mean, I don't think we have a choice. I mean, the door has been already open. It's been open.
We're getting to the point where we need the door open, come hell or high water, because it can't be worse than it is.
No, and it's already been opened, and it's how we react to the opening of the door that really makes us who we are as a human race. You know, one of the problems is that if you talk to the Native Americans, if you talk to the people in India, if you talk to the Aborigines, that door has been open forever. They can do interdimensional kinds of things. They can levitate. They can do, you know, they can talk to their ancestors. They don't have any problem in England with ghosts. You can even photograph them and catch them on film. So this is the only culture, this Western logical Newtonian Cartesian thinking, that has slammed the door on a reality that Aborigines and people, Native Americans, people know is normal. It's normal for them. You know, we're in a black hole because we haven't been told the truth. We don't have proper history. Our history needs to be rewritten totally. And this door is opening, and we've got a bunch of people running around confused.
Wait. Something went past just then that absolutely blew me away. We don't have a proper history, she says. Our history needs to be rewritten totally. Now, I won't ask you to rewrite history in the next 10 or 15 minutes, but I would like to get some sense of what you mean by that statement.
Well, I'm an ancient history teacher, too. I teach ancient history. I have a master's in education, so I have taught history for years. But I can give you one example that will help you understand. I was on the island of Sardinia, and the island of Sardinia has these enormous, enormous skulls and these enormous bones. And the common archaeology will not talk about it because it doesn't fit into any data bank.
Enormous bones?
Yeah, enormous
human
bones.
Human bones?
Giants. Yeah, they were giants on the island of Sardinia. Giants.
Well, why doesn't that surprise me since their Greek and mythology is full of giants?
Yeah, but we've got the bones in Sardinia. We have the tombs and the bones. and they won't go there mentally. What they're doing is archaeology doesn't have any frame of reference for that. So, and then Sardinia is a very, very unusual place. I mean, that's where we photograph most of the orbs. It's on my website, too, because I'm
Where do we find that on PaolaHarris.com?
Well, in Sacrabiza, there's pictures of this place, this kind of archaeological site that's just filled with orbs. I mean, everybody goes to photograph them there. And I went there in person. And the people that are studying this told me about the, and there's pictures and artifacts of these giants that live there. Okay, so what do you do? Do you want to rewrite history and say, on the earth there lived to be, you know, 10, 12-foot giants with huge skulls? And then what do you do? I mean, then you go to Egypt and you say, oh, well, let's see who lived here, and let's look at Samaria, and let's look at what really happened here. And unfortunately, because of the political power structure of planet Earth, and that includes the church, our history has been kind of written in a way for the advantage of the powerful. And our history doesn't talk about this other reality. So when you're looking at, you know, archaeology, and you're looking at the pyramids, and you're looking at Atlantis and all of that, somebody who is very intelligent will put all those pieces together and realize it fits together, that we as a species are probably inseminated from the stars. The visitations are not vacation. I always say that kiddingly. I don't think they picked this place to go on vacation. And there's something happening that we can't close the door on anymore. You said it before, you know, opening the dimensional door. Well, it's open. I mean, it depends on how we handle it from here on in.
And how should we handle it?
Well, I think for our children and our children's children and all the wonderful, new, intelligent children, I think it's time to tell the truth. I think it's time, and if we want to do it in a very, very slow way, it's time to have them look at this phenomenon and all of the phenomena surrounding it, including the paranormal, in an academic way. In other words, that it should be studied in classes, universities, and so forth. You can present a puzzle. You can say, well, look, we don't have the answers, but we're studying this. And that's far different than what's happening with the UFO phenomenon up until now.
Now, Paola, you are one of the people who has taken an interest in a little spoken about phenomenon, which is that of human-looking aliens, aliens who could walk among us. Have you ever met such a person?
No, but I would really like to. But I did speak to Timothy Good, and he is a great researcher. And basically, Timothy told me he had met at least two of them and communicated telepathically, and they were dressed like regular people. In fact, I have an interview with Timothy Good coming out where he told me where it happened, and he said also that he had met people that had met human-type aliens. My biggest story is the Maurizio Cavallo case. It is a contactee case in Vercelli, which is near Milano, and he had Polaroid pictures of what he calls the Federation, different human-looking people, who he says work among us. Now, if you want to go backwards in time to the 50s, you have Adamski with the Venusians. You have Meyer, and I do believe that case. I did go to see Billy Meyer. I know where he lives. I saw exactly what was happening there. We have the Pleiadians with Billy Meyer. There are human-looking aliens. Even Colonel Corso told me that the human-looking aliens were the ones that they were afraid of the most in the Pentagon because they couldn't tell the difference. He thinks that the grays that were at Roswell and several of the EBEs, he says, are laboratory-created biological entities by people that look like us. Well, that gets very, very tricky.
It certainly gets down deep into the world of paranoia. Yeah, he was fascinating to listen to when he talked about that kind of thing, Phil Corso was.
Well, he was telling the truth, and I'll tell you something. It's very sad. What lay between you and me, I was down in Roswell, and he wasn't even mentioned, and this is 60 years later. And there's a real serious problem with the infighting and the territoriality of the researchers in this country. He was a jewel. He was real. He was courageous. He was 82 years old, and he came forth with the truth. And we checked his background. He was the head of intelligence in Rome. He has credentials like you can't believe, and he did it for his grandson.
Yeah, I know it. And before Strom Thurmond, he was put to it by his people. Strom Thurmond wrote in support of Phil Corso because he knew Phil Corso, and he knew perfectly well he was telling the truth. But Thurmond was an old guy at the time, and you know, got a little bit bushwhacked, I guess, or. And the next thing you knew, he was pulling out of it because his advisors and his staffers were telling him, you can't talk about this subject.
Well, that's the problem. That is the policy in the United States. You can't talk about this subject.
Yeah, my wife always says it's more taboo than kinky sex.
Well, it's probably true. I mean, you can't use the word UFO. Now, why is England opening up the UFO files? Why is Brazil? Why did they give them to A.J. Gebhardt? Why did, the Cometa report come about? And why is Ireland opening its files? And why is the United States just not even dealing with it?
Well, the United States isn't dealing with it now because so many of the people in the government has been filled with Christian fundamentalists. I remember before the Congress became Republican, there was a high level of interest in this, and I should say interest in it at a high level, and they were working hard to understand what exactly had been hidden. And then the regime change came in, and the new people in Congress took one look at what the couple of committees that were involved in this had done and figured, this is just a bunch of these aren't aliens. These are demons. We already know what this is, and so we aren't going to fool with it anymore. And they forgot all about it, and the people in the intelligence community breathed a sigh of relief, and that's where it's been ever since.
Well, yeah, that's part of it, but I'm convinced. I'm one of the believers that it's the technology that keeps the secret because we have back-engineered technology. We have amazing stuff. Colonel Corso told me what he was in charge of, and he was.
Tell us about some of it.
Well, the night screening devices. You know, when I first met Corso, I asked him about the Santilli footage, and he said, well, you know, it's probably a copy of real footage, he says, because I know for a fact that the alien, that big black eye, is a light cover, because he said, I had it in the nut file, in the file that I had. He said, we used to play around in the Pentagon, walking up and down the hallways, looking through it, and we could see the furniture in the dark. So he said, I took that contract, and we made night screening devices. And he said, we spent all our time with, you know, with the microchip, the night screening devices, the Kevlar, you know, the high tenacity fibers, and all of that. He said, and we made weapons of war. He said, that's all we cared about. And it was the Army. It wasn't the Air Force, because I think the Air Force has its own artifacts. And the thing is that, you know, Colonel Corso was telling the truth. He was in charge of giving all his cash. I mean, it was cash because they didn't want to have, like, a trail to companies to back engineer, including that eye that I said it was a covering that he said that he had. He's not making that up. That's true. You know, this is stuff that evidently he said, well, you know, a lot of the soldiers in Vietnam, thanks to the night screening devices, were able to see in the dark. But, you know, the soldiers in Vietnam, I mean, you want to look at this planet, we're still playing around with a primitive society at war. So, yeah, we helped, and then, you know, we've got night screening devices, but I think that the answer is going to have to be much more of a spiritual one.
Paola Harris, we have come to the end of our time together, amazingly enough, and we are at Paola Harris's website is paolaharris.com, her new book, Exopolitics. Her earlier book, Connecting the Dots, you can get them from her website. You can go to Amazon.com and get them. You can even get them from our Amazon.com store. Paola, thank you so much for being with us. Next up on Dreamland, Linda Moulton Howe. The new year is upon us, and as she has been doing every year for the past 10 years, Linda is going to interview Gerard Celente, the editor of Trends Magazine, and I have not heard this yet, but Linda Moulton Howe has already told me that in the 10 years of interviewing him, she has never heard such a dire forecast for our economy and our country's future. So listen up and listen carefully. At the end, there will be some suggestions about what to do to take shelter take economic shelter, should something like this begin to unfold. And Gerard will tell you exactly what to watch for. Go to Linda Moulton Howe's earthfiles.com every day. It's the best website of its kind in the world. Brought to you by Emmy Award winner Linda Moulton Howe, and here she is from Albuquerque.
Thanks, Whitley, and Merry Christmas and almost Happy New Year. It sounds from Gerald Celente at the Trends Journal that 2008 could be quite a rough year financially. On December 19th, 2007, the Federal Reserve announced it was lending another $20 billion to American banks in the first of four special auctions designed to help alleviate the credit crunch on Wall Street caused by the subprime loan collapse in real estate. That $20 billion brings the total money pumped into the United States financial sector since June of 2007 to about $500 billion. In its announcement, the Federal Reserve said it was responding to requests for another $61.6 billion in loans, illustrating strong demand by banks that need short-term funds. Some market experts doubt that this latest infusion of cash will help much. Barry Reitholtz, director of equity research for Fusion IQ, told CNN, quote, "This is a crisis of confidence, not of liquidity or rate. The problem is that people made bad loans. There's nothing the Fed can do to fix this. All they can do is try and reduce anxiety," unquote. And in the December 24th, 2007 issue of Newsweek, financial columnist Robert Samuelson wrote about, quote, "a sequel to the subprime mess. The obvious danger is another wave of large losses and a chain reaction of fear that paralyzes and cripples investors, particularly banks," unquote. This is exactly the subject that leads off the 2008 trends list in the Trends Journal, written and published by Gerald Celente in Rhinebeck, New York. Mr. Celente has often been interviewed by network newscasters, and his trend predictions are generally correct. This week, I talked to him about trends he sees for 2008, beginning with the top of his list, Economic 9/11.
Economic 9/11, we believe, is going to hit the United States in 2008. And just as the World Trade Centers toppled from the top down, we're going to see the crash happen from the top down as well. This talk about, you know, the subprime market, yeah, that's a problem. But nothing compared to when the big firms start failing, when banks go bust, brokerages go out of business. We're going to see some major giant firms fall, get hit by an economic 9/11. We don't know what the fuse will look like, but we know that the bomb is set already. And when it's lit, we believe it's going to happen before June of 2008.
What, Gerald, has set this in motion?
Well, in 2007, we saw the real first cracks, but it really has to be understood that it's been underway for a long time, and they've been fueling the economy with low interest rates. That's what's got us out of the 2001 recession that followed after the bubble burst, the dot-com bubble. They lowered interest rates to 46-year lows. They flooded the world marketplace with cheap dollars. No one wants them anymore, not even vendors in third world countries. So what happened in 2007, the cracks became apparent to everyone. Wall Street's in a problem. And what do we have to save the ship of state from sinking? Well, look ahead, because that's what we do as trend forecasters. Who do we have? We have a know-nothing president and a do-nothing Congress and wannabes in waiting that lack the intelligence, the integrity, the competence, credentials, character, and courage to do what a wise leader would do in times when the ship is sinking. So we're saying it's going down. There's nothing there to save it.
And what was it that provoked all of the financial institutions to move so heavily into this subprime on the real estate market in the past couple of years that have led to such a crisis?
It's called greed and gambling, and it goes well beyond the subprime market. I mean, you know, there's a company in New York, and according to the New York Times, Macklow Real Estate, they control about $7 billion worth of real estate. And the headline read how brilliant they were. They did it with $30 million down. And that's what all of these deals have been. They've been doing these deals with no money down. All of a sudden, Carlyle, Blackstone, groups we never heard of before, you know, only those who really study these things. And all of a sudden, they're buying major corporations that are worth billions and billions of dollars. They're doing this with fake money. This is why people go to Princeton, Yale, Harvard, and the Ivy League schools, so they can get together and do the big deals. And what they do is when as things starts falling out, they point to the little people, the little, you know, oh, look at that, they went over their head, they should have read the fine print. This is the subprime is just the crack. The real big thing is going to happen, and the real dirty deals have been done are on the top. There were all these leveraged buyouts, Chrysler Corporation being bought up, or Cerebus. Who ever heard of Cerebus? Look who's on the board of directors, Jack Snow, the former Treasury Secretary. Hey, remember Dan Quayle? They found a job for him. He's on it, too. So this is what's going on, Linda. It's bigger than them getting into the greed market of fleecing the little people. They're bringing down the whole system, and it's under out of control. The Swiss bank announced they're going to be selling 250 tons of gold between now and September of 2009 so they could buy more money to keep this thing afloat.
And this is leading to the second trend on your list of the panic of 2008. What do you think is going to happen?
Just as when panic struck when 9/11 hit, panic's going to hit the streets again following the economic 9/11. They're not going to know what to do. They're going to be frozen. You know, I just got an email from a publication up where I am, up in the Hudson Valley, Dutchess Magazine. It's a very affluent area, you know, Millbrook and Rhinebeck. We're in Rhinebeck. And every year they used to do a cover story of my trends. This year they're not running them, because, according to the letter that they sent me, some of the readers and advertisers found them unpalatable. They don't like to hear the truth. The central banks have already, they're pumping in over $500 billion already. They've been pumping money in. Actually, if you go back to our Trends Journal, the summer edition, the mid-year report, we said 2 weeks before the Dow hit 14,000 and the Chinese markets hit their highest level ever, to get ready because we saw a financial crisis hitting. The financial crisis hit exactly on July 24th of this year, when the Dow lost well over 200 points. And that was the beginning of the crack. And they've been pumping money into the banking system since that time. They've had bigger bailouts than even that happened after 9/11. It's out of control. These are all of the fiat currencies are going to be worth dimes on the dollars in the future. And the first one that's going to go is going to be the dollar. And that's why one of our big trends for 2008 is bye-bye bucks.
That's where you say America's going broke and the whole world knows it?
Except the Americans. And what they say, oh, it's so good. It's so good for business. It allows us to export. So all of you low-paid workers out there, you know, our currency is worth so little that they could now buy our products cheaper. So no longer is made in America a standard of high quality. It means buy it cheap. And that does not build a strong economy. For example, right now, the biggest rage in New York area of foreigners coming over and going to these high-end shopping malls, like where they have, you know, Versace and that kind of stuff, and going on these wild spending sprees. America has gone from first class to third rate in a blink of an eye. We no longer shop the world for bargains. The dollar is so cheap, they're coming here in droves, and forget the retail. Before you know it, Linda, they're going to buy up this country. If the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates to make Wall Street happy so they could continue to finance the mega deals that they put together, that crashes the dollar, because a low interest rates means cheaper dollars. You buy them at less money, and foreigners are going to start, as they already are, they're bailing out of U.S. bucks. They're trying to do it in an orderly way so they don't crash the market. So the big guys are going to get out first, and you're going to start seeing more and more. They're going to keep trying to prop up the dollar so there's an orderly retreat. We're saying that by the time the dust settles and the smoke is cleared, the dime on the dollar is going to be the slogan of the future. When the history books remember 2008 as the panic of 2008.
And how does that lead to the fourth top trends, 2008, tax revolt? And I'm asking this question in this way. It seems that at this point, the American public is intimidated, overwhelmed, and afraid of their government. They're afraid of the IRS. How can there be a tax revolt in a nation that has been operating and managing by fear?
We think it's going to happen at the local level. People can't afford to pay property taxes or school taxes. And when you look at the demographics in just virtually every major community, there are more people without children living in those homes, whether single or empty nesters, than people with children. So they can't afford the school tax, and then most parts of the country, school taxes are based upon property taxes. So it's all on the homeowner's shoulders. You're going to see a revolt coming there, and you're also going to see revolts regarding property tax rises. If they're going to keep inflating as the value of the home becomes less, then, well, if you had to pay more when the value went up when they reassessed, we're going to have to reassess downward. We're going to be fair about this.
What would be the first signs that you would be looking for that the United States was going to be in a full-bore recession
Watch when one of the big firms crash. That's the sign. Watch, like, a major bank, when that kind of thing happens, that's going to be the first signal.
And that was what was going to happen to Countrywide Bank this summer, right?
Right, but even bigger than that, much bigger, like a Bank of America, not that necessarily to be it, but of that caliber. Look for something big to break. So we're in a recession already. You don't have to wait for the government's official statistics. Look at what they do. What they do is comparable to when I grew up during the Cold War, what the Soviet Union used to do. They put out this deceptive basket of statistics. They talk about inflation. Oh, we're not adding in food and fuel. Or why not?
Well, because according to the pointy-headed professor who says the mean of this line dissects with that line.
Wait, what do you mean you're not putting in food and fuel? Who are you talking to, folks? You know, so this is what's going on.
That makes it completely artificial when they talk about inflation without two of the biggest, which is fuel and food.
It's criminal. It's criminal, and they're doing the same thing with the unemployment numbers. Once you're off the rolls, hey, you're not looking for work anymore. You know, so we're in a recession. The people are feeling it. Every time that nozzle hits the gas tank, there's panic. When people fill up their car, who could afford this stuff? And these clowns on TV saying the consumer is resilient. So anyway, we're warning that there are very rough times ahead and for people to take precaution now.
How can people take precaution when there seems to be rocky financial territory ahead of everybody, including perhaps the rich and the corporations in the next few months?
One thing is, don't buy any stuff you don't need. There's this Christmas stupidity of going out and knocking yourself out to buy a lot of things a lot of people don't want that you can't afford is not an intelligent way to make decisions. And that brings us, by the way, into another trend, which is positive. Conservation engineers. How to conserve. How to use more of what you have to a more efficient way and bring in new materials and processes so that we can conserve more. You know, we don't call this the green movement. It's the smart movement. And that's what we're going to see. So there's going to be great job opportunities, great entrepreneurial opportunities for people that become conservation engineers, conservation specialists, using products, services, and intelligence that brings us out of the dark age of overconsumption that we've been in for so long.
And it has been provoked by a government who basically says, you consumers, it is your job to go out and spend to keep the economy going.
I know. What kind of craziness is this? You know, you're even hearing people like Warren Buffett, the second richest man in the world, warning the nation that it's turning into a plutocracy. I mean, this is him. He's intelligent enough to know. Look, Aristotle was alleged to have said the strength of a nation is built on its middle class, and dumb is dangerous. The more ignorant people are, the more desperate they are, the more it hurts all of us. It's in everyone's best interest to have an informed, intelligent society.
We have been in a country that has been cowed by a government policy of fear in all directions. People are afraid to stand up for themselves, and that's what makes me wonder, how do you get to these better steps on your trends, like small is big and heal yourself healthcare? How do you get there when it is the entrenched greed corporations that don't want us to wake up and change?
Because the vacuum is so big right now, all of the institutions are failing. You name it, education, healthcare, military, economic, medical, they're all failing. When the vacuum is this big, it can be filled with anything. It could be filled with more fascism, bigotry, and hypocrisy, or it could be filled with beauty, art, love, and understanding, and dignity, and passion, and respect. It's up to us to fill it, but people have to do it in their individual lives.
People can't do anything unless they go to banks to borrow money to get things accomplished, and then you're right back dealing with the people who have put us in this problem in the first place.
That's only part of it. Nobody broke the people's arms to go take out home equity loans.
Mm-hmm.
They did it on their own free will. And people are spending way beyond their means. Nobody out there forced people to build McMansions or drive SUVs. They did it all on their own. The people have to become more intelligent. They become lazy and information ignorant. And until they change, nothing's going to change. And I believe it's going to change because there are enough people that want it to. It's not everybody is a Paris Hilton fan.
But the final trend that you have, technoslaves.com, when I read it, I thought that's absolutely true, that the younger generation especially is becoming numbed by iPods and Xboxes. And how in the world do you educate a generation that is so techno-slaved?
They're going to have a very difficult time because they've been built up with this false belief that somehow they're special because they can hit little buttons really fast, you know, move their fingers nimbly over little keys. It's a worldwide epidemic. They're becoming techno slaves. Every time that phone rings, it has to be answered as though it's something ranging between life and death. Is going to be solved in the next few seconds. And it's not like I haven't been here and didn't know when the whole cell phone thing happened. You know, it's a choice that I don't have one. All my friends, I'm only going to use it in emergencies. And now you're having a conversation between two people in the flesh and somebody from over the fence from when, who knows where, they ring. Up, your conversation breaks, the train of thought goes with it. The playing field, we believe, is going to be broken down to more and more local, more self-sustaining. You don't have to get all these products coming from all these countries. So we see a real breaking down. And actually, we also see a renaissance. We think this is the end of the Dark Ages and that people are going to start going back to higher quality. And when we raise the quality bar, then everything goes up with it. And that's a strength, by the way, that the United States has, if we get the kind of leadership that could push us into that kind of a direction.
Gerald Celente also thinks that the American government is going to have to devalue the dollar inside of the United States, similar to what Argentina had to do several years ago. At least Argentina is starting to bounce back economically. But what will happen in the United States? What do you think, Whitley?
Linda, I'm terrified. I have to tell you that there was nothing he said that I don't think is a strong possibility. We
right.
are really in a bind because we have a situation where the economy cannot sustain higher interest rates. It's impossible, but inflation is killing us.
Right.
And we also have a situation where we can't lower interest rates without having the dollar fall through the floor abroad.
Right.
So, we're between the devil and the deep blue sea here. And I think it's now called a rock and a hard place, but I've got a feeling it's the same place.
Or a Chinese torture on the fingers that you can't pull it off. And if this is the way things are, we're in a straitjacket right now, and it's very clear that many, many people are hurting financially.
You know, and people who have money to invest are wondering. There is a newsletter called ETFGuide.com, which keeps up with exchange-traded funds. And one of the things that you can do is you can get into exchange-traded funds that are in different currencies. So you can insulate yourself a little bit against the dollar if you want to, folks. And you can read more about this in last weekend's Financial Times. And I believe their website is ft.com or ft.co.uk. There is an article in it by Rebecca Knight, which tells you how to invest in such a way that you don't have total dollar exposure, and that might not be a bad idea, given what he's telling us.
And what do you think would happen if there is, even if it's orderly, that there is a backing away from the American dollar by countries all over the world, switching to the euro, which has been the big threat for now a couple of years, but it may be that suddenly China and Saudi Arabia and other countries that have tried to help us decide they're going to switch to the euro?
Well, there's a physical problem with that in that there aren't enough euros around. Switching is easier said than done. It has to be a gradual process, and it's already happening. Middle Eastern oil countries have been trading more and more in euros over the past few years, over the past 4 or 5 years, and a country like China is stuck with its dollars. There's nothing they can do.
Mm-hmm.
They can't suddenly decide to shift into the euro, not without making their dollars worthless.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're not going to do. It's unfortunately for the world, and fortunately, very fortunately for us, it's in the interest of the world not to let the dollar fall through the floor. If the dollar does fall through the floor, it means that the world economy has fallen through the floor.
Right. What do you think, from your experience and your gut, might happen over the next 2 years here in the United States?
Well, I'll tell you this. I can outline it fairly accurately. First of all, our problems, our environmental problems with food supply and abrupt environmental changes are going to get very serious.
Mm-hmm.
Second, with regard to the economy, and it always ties into this directly because we're going to see dramatically increased food prices next year along with inflation and the Fed unable to do anything about it except raise interest rates, which isn't directly germane because if food prices are rising, they're rising because of the fact that there isn't enough food.
Right.
Duh. I think that other countries, third world countries, are going to suffer greatly from this. I do not believe that there will be a collapse in the dollar, but I don't think the dollar is going to become a strong currency anytime soon. And I think that this gradual decline of the dollar is the reason to invest in foreign currency denominated EFTs.
Right.
Because over the next 5 or 6 years, in addition to any appreciation you may get in those EFTs from market activity, you will get appreciation from the declining dollar over 4 years of about 35 to 40%. If the dollar does decline another 35 to 40% by 2010 or 2011, then I think there is a possibility that there would be a run on the dollar and the dollar could collapse. Now, all of that said, if we have a big bank, candidate number one is Citibank or a bank with hidden problems, that goes belly up, all bets are off.
Right, which is what Gerald Celeni thinks could happen in this country by June of 2008.
Well, the country's maxed out. The United States credit card is maxed out. We can't borrow any more money. We're all too heavily in debt. We can't do it. And the result of this is going to be that the economy is going to stop growing. And there's already indications of this in the Christmas season. The women's wear area, which is a very important part of the Christmas season, is suffering this year, meaning people are not buying gifts in women's wear this year.
Right.
And that is generally a sign of a weaker retail economy to come in the next year. Linda, speaking of weak, we're not weak. We are strong as we can be. And Dreamland, by the way, folks, and I want to thank you for this, is getting more and more listeners. Do you know we're getting 5,000 listeners a day on this radio program?
Fantastic.
And it's because this is where you go if you want a serious, in-depth look at what's really going on in the world. There isn't any other place. I mean, unless you're interested in Paris Hilton, forget it. So I would like to thank everyone, to wish everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we're going to be back next year in spades with all kinds of incredibly cool new stuff, including more Linda Moulton Howe. So thank you very much, everybody, and Merry Christmas.